So last week we introduced the series that we're kind of entering into. It's a series that's going to take us right through to Easter. As people who take seriously the reality of God and the way and work of Jesus and the presence of the Spirit of Christ, the possibility of a divine encounter should be something we're open to. We perhaps should be even prepared for the probability of encountering God. And so to help us foster our imagination and openness to this, and to help us sharpen our discernment about what divine encounters might be like, we're walking through Scripture and looking at some divine encounters that took place with biblical characters. What do they show us about who God is, and what might we be able to learn about ourselves in relationship to God and divine encounters? So last week we began in the beginning. We rehearsed the beginning of the biblical story and dug into the encounter Adam and Eve had with God on the heels of bringing brokenness and mess into the world that previously only knew goodness and peace. Originally, I was going to take just a really short step forward and talk about Cain. Very interesting encounters with God in Cain's story, but much of what we learned in that story aligns with what we explored last week. So we're going to skip further ahead to the book of Genesis, and we are starting in Genesis 12. This week. At the very end of Genesis 11, we get introduced to a man named Abram. It's at the beginning of Genesis 12 that Abram really takes center stage for a while. Over the course of like 13 chapters from Genesis 12 to 22, Abram has multiple encounters with God. And the stories of these encounters are interspersed with other events in his life. Now you likely know Abram by the name he received partway through his journey in Genesis, Abraham. So I'm just going to refer to him as Abraham for the sake of ease and not having to switch back and forth. Abraham is arguably one of the most significant people in world history. I say that because he's considered a patriarch to Jews, Christians, and Muslims. As such, over 56% of today's global population claims to be a part of Abraham's lineage in some way, shape, or form, either spiritually or genetically. But what made Abraham so significant wasn't his knowledge or his strength or his wealth. It was his encounters with God and what the record of those encounters say was true about Abraham. That's what has led to him being recognized and remembered for close to 4,000 years. I should mention that keeping this somewhat brief has been a bit of a challenge. I was actually wrestling with doing a whole sermon series around Abraham. And so before settling on doing this as a part of this series. So this morning we're going to be rehearsing content that could have been the basis for like many, many weeks of sermons, so please buckle up. I will try to get through it quickly. I'm not going to sit with, there's so much more. You, like if I go through something and you're like, but wait, what about? Yeah, I know, what about? But we got to keep going for this morning. So within Abraham's life, there's several encounters with God, and we're going to kind of switch between looking at those specific divine encounters and then just quickly rehearsing the stuff that happens between those encounters. And hopefully by doing that, we'll be able to get through this quickly and still be thorough enough to help us connect what Abraham experiences with the realities of our own life with God. So let's start by reading Genesis 12, 1. This is the first encounter. It says, "The Lord had said to Abraham, 'Leave your native country, your relatives, and your father's family, and go to the land that I will show you. I will make you into a great nation. I will bless you and make you famous, and you will be a blessing to others. I will bless those who bless you and curse those who treat you with contempt. All the families on earth will be blessed through you.' So Abram departed as the Lord had instructed, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he left Haran. He took his wife Sarai, his nephew Lot, and all his wealth, his livestock, and all the people he had taken into his household at Haran, and headed for the land of Canaan. When they arrived in Canaan, Abram traveled through the land as far as Shechem. There he set up camp beside the oak of Moreh. At that time, the area was inhabited by Canaanites. Then the Lord appeared to Abram and said, 'I will give this land to your descendants.' And Abram built an altar there and dedicated it to the Lord who had appeared to him. After that, Abram traveled south and set up camp in the hill country with Bethel to the west and Ai to the east. There he built another altar and dedicated it to the Lord, and he worshiped the Lord. Within this section, which I'm simply referring to as Abraham's call, there are three things to note. The first is that it's God who does the calling. God initiates this whole thing. I do find it fascinating that he waits until he's 75 years old to even start this. So if some of us are feeling like we're a bit behind, hey, you're okay. But God does the calling. God initiates this encounter. He invites Abraham into something. And alongside this invitation, God also offers a commitment to Abraham. And God initiates this commitment. It's not coerced. It's not forced. God comes to this engagement and this invitation with an open-handed offering. Abraham's not holding back. He's like, well, I'll do that if you do that. No, God comes offering this commitment. And the third thing we see here is what I'm calling Abraham's conversion. Like literally his change of direction from where he was to where he is going. It's Abraham's response to the call and the commitment that moves things forward. This is the first divine encounter we're aware of in Abraham's life. Abraham follows God to the land God has for him. As you move through the story, though, and this is like we're moving quickly, a famine hits the land that they end up in. And so to get food, Abraham takes his whole household, and we'll get a sense of just how big that is in just a little bit, but he takes his whole household down to Egypt. There, Pharaoh sets his eye on Sarah, or Sarai at the time. Abraham is married to Sarah, also a half-brother. Abraham simply says that Sarah is his sister out of fear that Pharaoh might kill him to get to his wife. It says something about the beauty of Sarah. But because, that's his sister, Pharaoh thinks everything's good. So Pharaoh brings Sarah into his house to be a bride and then gives Abraham all kinds of wealth and livestock in exchange. And then Pharaoh, because of Sarah, starts to get with all kinds of plagues until he figures out what's happened. And then he summons Abraham and says, why did you lie to me? Why did you set me up for trouble? He then gives Sarah back to Abraham and kicks him out of the country. There's no direct engagement with God there, but it moves the story forward. At this point in the story, they go back to the land that God had promised and told them to go to. And Abraham is traveling with his nephew Lot. They've both gotten fairly wealthy. They have pretty large flocks and households of people to support. But because the flocks are large, there's conflicts over limited water and feeding areas between Abraham's men and Lot's men. And so they decide that they're going to split up. Abraham gives Lot the choice of direction, and Lot chooses to go to this fertile valley down near the city of Sodom. Abraham goes the other direction into Canaan. And then here there's another encounter with God that's really a recommitment, a confirmation, if you will, that God's going to give this land to Abraham. God says these things to Abraham. He says, after Lot had gone, the Lord said to Abram, look as far as you can see in every direction, north and south, east and west. I'm giving all this land as far as you can see to you and your descendants as a permanent possession. And I will give you so many descendants that like the dust of the earth, they cannot be counted. Go and walk through the land in every direction, for I am giving it to you. This is another encounter, but it's a confirmation of what was previously offered with the call and commitment. It continues forward in the story. In the next chapter, Abraham is drawn into tribal battles because what happened is Lot's gone down to Sodom, and the king of Sodom gets attacked and people get taken captive, and among them is Lot. Abraham, because he wants to rescue his nephew, he mobilizes a personal militia of 318 men who are trained to fight. That gives you a sense of how large his household was when we talk about his whole household moving. So he goes off with these 318 men. He rescues Lot, and in order to rescue Lot, he has to fight on behalf of the king of Sodom, and so he gives victory to the king of Sodom. And the king of Sodom wants to give Abraham all the loot that was recovered, but Abraham won't take any of it. There's an interesting interaction where Abraham receives a divine blessing from a mysterious priest named Melchizedek. to whom Abraham in turn gives 10% of the bounty he recovered before giving the rest of it back to the king of Sodom. Again, no direct encounter with God during that portion. But then we turn over to Genesis 15. Here we have another significant divine encounter between Abraham and God. This is where we read about a covenant God makes with Abraham. For the sake of time, I'm not going to read the whole chapter, despite the fact that it's a very significant encounter. In this encounter, God shows up in a vision. In the vision, God clarifies for Abraham that his servant, so Abraham has a servant that he thinks is going to be his heir because he doesn't have a son. It's a very common practice, pick a favorite servant and they'll get all Abraham's household when he's done. God clarifies, nope, that servant is not going to be your heir. You're going to have a biological son. And God insists that Abraham will have descendants that number like stars in the sky. In response, we read in verse 6, it says, Abraham believed the Lord, and the Lord counted him as righteous because of his faith. Fascinating. This guy is an old man already, and God says, you're going to have a biological son, and you're going to have all these descendants from it. Abraham's like, okay, I believe you. The chapter continues with God reiterating that Abraham is going to be given the land that he's currently living in. In response to this, Abraham says, oh, sovereign Lord, how can I be sure I'll actually possess it? He believes about the son. He doesn't believe about the land. And in response to his doubt, God, in what we still presume is a vision based on how it's told, calls Abraham to bring three animals. He kills the animals and cuts them in half. And then the story says Abraham falls into a deep sleep. And in his dream, God tells Abraham about 4 centuries of slavery that his descendants are going to endure before God rescues them with great wealth and returns them to this land. In the story, Abraham then sees some strange imagery. It's got some association with some ancient sacrificial imagery. We're not going to get into it right now for time. But then God, again, restates that this land is going to be given to Abraham's descendants. And then in verse 18, it says, so the Lord made a covenant with Abram that day. God makes his covenant with Abram because Abraham doubts and isn't sure. This is for Abram's sake, not for God's sake. And we won't get into the significance of this covenant for those who are first reading this story. That would take us down a really long rabbit trail. So let's just continue with the story as it's told here in Genesis. In Genesis 16, after this covenant foundation, Abraham and Sarah, again, there's no encounter with God in this section, not with Abraham anyway, they conspire to get Abraham an heir by having him impregnate Sarah's servant, Hagar. Again, not an uncommon practice in that era. We're going to explore chapter 16 more in more detail next week because there is a divine encounter there that is really fascinating between Hagar and God, and we're going to spend some time looking at that one. For now, suffice it to say, Abraham's first son, Ishmael, is born. Abraham is 86 years old at the time. Chapter 17, we read about another encounter that Abraham has when, at this point, Abraham is 99. It kind of jumps 13 years. Abraham is 99 years old, and we get to this encounter in chapter 17. In chapter 17, that's when, in an encounter with God, that's when his name changes from Abram to Abraham. And God changes his wife's name from Sarai to Sarah. In discussing Sarah, God actually tells Abraham that Sarah is going to be the one who has the son that's the heir to all of the promise and the covenant and the blessing and everything that God has offered. And Abraham asks, like, can't it be Ishmael? He obviously loves his son who is now 13, and God says, no, it's going to be Sarah's child who is the son of this promise. God reiterates in this encounter in chapter 17 the covenant he has made with Abraham, and then he calls on Abraham to actually adopt a mark of the covenant, a symbol for all men in Abraham's household, that they were participants in this great covenant with God. A covenant symbol is very normal. When covenants were made between parties, they would adopt some type of symbol. We didn't get that initially. We get it here. The symbol is circumcision, and Abraham brings out all the males in this huge household and circumcises them that day. At this point, the questions in my mind are like, how did he convince all these men that this was the result of a divine encounter and a good idea? Well, that's what happened in the story. So we've got these divine encounters that have been happening, interspersed with other events. First one, that the call to Abraham to follow and the promise of great blessing in terms of wealth and family. A divine encounter that reconfirms God's commitment to Abraham. We have a divine encounter in which God moves things beyond just a promise and enters into a covenant for Abraham's sake and certainty. And then we have this divine encounter in which Abraham and his wife have their name changed. Abraham is told that he will have a son with Sarah, and Abraham is called to adopt this covenant mark, identifying all the men who are participating in this covenant along with him. That's through 17. Then we get to 18. In chapter 18, we get another divine encounter. This one is interesting because it seems like for most of the encounter, Abraham doesn't know he's encountering God. We know as the readers because the narrator tells us that's what's happening. The chapter begins this way. It says, "The Lord appeared again to Abraham near the oak grove belonging to Mamre." So we're told this is God showing up. And then it says, "One day Abraham was sitting at the entrance to his tent during the hottest part of the day. He looked up and noticed three men standing nearby. When he saw them, he ran to meet them and welcomed them, bowing low to the ground. 'My Lord,' he says," that's small L, Lord, like that's just a term of respect at this point. He says, "If it pleases you, stop here for a while. Rest in the shade of this tree while water is brought to wash your feet. And since you've honored your servant with this visit, let me prepare some food to refresh you before you continue on your journey." Some have suggested that these three men are representative of the triunity of God. They accept Abraham's hospitality and rest in the shade while Abraham serves them a wonderful meal. Following the meal, the men ask where Sarah is. This encounter starts in verse 9. Let me just read that for you. It says, "Where is Sarah, your wife?" the visitors ask. "She's inside the tent," Abraham replied. Then one of them said, "I will return to you about this time next year, and your wife Sarah will have a son." Sarah was listening to this conversation from the tent. Abraham and Sarah were both very old by this time, and Sarah was long past the age of having children. So she laughed silently to herself and said, "How could a worn-out woman like me enjoy such pleasure? Especially when my master, my husband, is also so old." Then the Lord said to Abraham, "Why did Sarah laugh? Why did she say, 'Can an old woman like me have a baby?' Is anything too hard for the Lord? I will return about this time next year, and Sarah will have a son." Sarah was afraid, so she denied it, saying, I didn't laugh. But the Lord said, "No, you did laugh." At this point, the men get up to leave, and they actually look towards Sodom, and they start in that direction. Abraham, to see them off, starts to walk with them for a little bit. There is what appears to be a dialogue between the men, like not between them and Abraham. It's written as though God is kind of talking to himself with these three men. It's really fascinating how it's worded, but the end result is that God decides to tell Abraham about a plan to destroy Sodom and the neighboring city of Gomorrah because of the level of wickedness that exists there. As a really brief aside, there is no mention of homosexuality in this account. That would be a whole other rabbit trail to pursue, but it's good to recognize that this doesn't mention it at all. So God shares this intent to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, and at this point, it seems like Abraham clues into the fact that he's encountering God. Like, oh, this isn't just three guys who showed up. God's telling me about this plan to destroy these places. But Abraham's nephew Lot and his family live there, and he doesn't want them to get destroyed, so he begins to negotiate with God. I use the word contend because I'm trying to find a bunch of C's, but he can contend with God. He says, "You know, if there's 50 righteous people, won't you save the cities? It doesn't make sense to destroy the righteous and the wicked. That's not justice, and surely the judge of the universe wants to do what's right." And so God agrees and says, okay, I won't destroy the cities if I can find 50 righteous people. So Abraham, I can kind of imagine him like, okay, how do I do this? Well, what if there's 45? Like, surely for 45, for the sake of five people, you wouldn't destroy it, because let's move it back to 45, and he negotiates again. God says, okay, I'll spare it for 45 people. Well, what about 40? Okay, I'll spare it for 40. And Abraham seems emboldened by this, and quickly it moves, well, how about 30? Maybe 20? How about 10? And God commits to not destroying Sodom and Gomorrah if 10 righteous people can be found. And then it just kind of wraps up the conversation. It says, okay, when that conversation was done, God, in the form of these men, go on their way, and Abraham goes back to his tent. Kind of a strange, abrupt ending. Chapter 19 doesn't have Abraham in it at all, so we aren't going to rehearse any of the events in detail, but the summary is that God proceeds with the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. God also sends two angels, two messengers into the city who rescue Lot and his daughters. We move ahead to chapter 20. Again, no divine encounter. There are some three interesting things that happen. Abraham is a traveling nomad, moves around to different areas. He ends up living close to and interacting with a king named Abimelech. And Abraham, out of the same fear as he had before, introduces Sarah as his sister. Deceives Abimelech. Abimelech takes her as his wife, which, just again, she's like at this point like 89 years old. Says something about her. But in the end, Abimelech finds out. He's like, what are you doing to me, Abraham? And he ends up giving Abraham a bunch of gifts of gold and servants and livestock as he gets sent on his way. In chapter 21, again, no specific divine encounter, but three significant events. The first is that Sarah bears her first child. Isaac is born. What God has promised has happened. The second is that Sarah, as they're circumcising Isaac and committing him, she looks over and sees Ishmael kind of making fun of Isaac, and she gets upset and instigates Abraham sending Hagar and Ishmael away. The third thing that happens is that Abimelech comes and negotiates a treaty with Abraham. And then we get to chapter 22, the final chapter that we are going to note today. Here we have God call Abraham and give him the instruction. He says, take your son, your only son, yes, Isaac, whom you love so much, and go to the land of Moriah. Go and sacrifice him as a burnt offering on one of the mountains, which I will show you. With no indication as to how he feels about this, Abraham calls his servant and Isaac, and they head out. On the third day of their journey, as they get closer to their destination, Abraham leaves behind the servant. He puts the wood for the sacrifice on Isaac's back. Abraham carries the fire and the knife that they need, and they continue to walk. Isaac is he's got pretty good sense of observation. So he asks his father, hey, we have the fire and we have the wood, but where's the sheep for the sacrifice? Where's the sheep for the burnt offering? Abraham replies, well, God will provide the sheep for the burnt offering, my son. The story continues as follows, reading it, verse 9. It says, when they arrived at the place where God had told them to go, Abraham built an altar and arranged the wood on it. Then he tied up his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. And Abraham picked up the knife to kill his son as a sacrifice. At that moment, the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven, Abraham, Abraham! Yes, Abraham replied, here I am. Don't lay a hand on the boy, the angel said. Do not hurt him in any way, for now I know that you truly fear God. You have not withheld from me even your son, your only son. Then Abraham looked up and saw a ram caught by its horns in a thicket. So he took the ram and sacrificed it as a burnt offering in place of his son. Abraham named the place Yahweh Yireh, which means the Lord will provide. To this day, people still use that name as a proverb. On the mountain of the Lord, it will be provided. In response to Abraham's willingness to sacrifice his own son, God affirms a blessing over Abraham. He reconfirms his promise to give him descendants that number like the stars in the sky and the sand on the seashore. And then the voice of God continues by saying, "Your descendants will conquer the cities of their enemies, and through your descendants all the nations of the earth will be blessed, all because you have obeyed me." Then they, Abraham and Isaac, returned to the servants and traveled back to Beersheba, where Abraham continued to live. There's a whole lot that could be said about this exchange. But for now, I'd like just to note that God called on Abraham to do something that didn't make sense and didn't seem to be in alignment with the plan God had laid out. It didn't seem to be in alignment with how God had worked. For the first readers of this, it would have been shocking, because one of the biggest things the nation of Israel consistently said was one of the biggest things that were abhorrent to God. It was sacrificing children. That was one of the things that was supposed to set them apart from nations around them that would go that far. In the end, at the end of the story, it's revealed that it wasn't in alignment with God's plan. So we're left with kind of confusing questions. Did Abraham mishear God when he started this? Did Abraham presume God wouldn't actually require him to go ahead with this? Was this a test that God was never going to let it happen anyway, but he wanted to see where Abraham's heart was? That was this something that was added by editors later in order to help Israel have confidence as they went into battle, because it talks about your descendants are going to be able to win in battle. The answer to these questions isn't clear in the text. What is clear is that this divine encounter for both Abraham and for the readers is kind of confusing. Its purpose wasn't clear. Even what it seems to say about God is confusing. But in the end, despite the confusion, God provided what was needed and reaffirmed his promise to Abraham. I'm not going to try and solve the confusion, but I do want us to note that God did provide what was needed and reaffirmed his promise to Abraham. So what do we do with all these encounters? How do we bring all of this to some sense of closure this morning? Something that connects Abraham's journey and our own. We have all these divine encounters. We have divine encounters where God calls or invites someone into something. We have divine encounters where God makes promises. We have a divine encounter where God is just simply reminding, hey, remember that promise that was made. Divine encounters where God moves deeper and says, like, it wasn't just a promise. You need something more than that. I'll give you something more than that so that you know that this is true. Divine encounters where God calls someone to mark themselves out in their relationship with him. Divine encounters where God meets with someone in deeply personal ways, such as, like, hey, you're going to have a son. Divine encounters where people argue with God and negotiate with God, and God does the same in turn. Divine encounters that in which people struggle to make sense of what's been said and what's happened, and they don't seem to be in line with what they've known to be true of God. Not only that, these divine encounters, some of them seem to be visions. Some of them are God's voice speaking. Some, God shows up. Some, it looks like just a person that's there in front of them. They happen and they unfold in different ways. As we listen to Abraham's story and consider this series of different kinds of divine encounters, all of which are interspersed with, like, and then this happened, and then this happened, where doesn't seem like there's an encounter with God at all going on, perhaps we're best served to just look through that and recognize that divine encounters, they don't stand on their own. They're a part of a lifelong encounter with God in which we get different experiences with God depending on what we need or what we're open to at any given time. More important than being than having a divine encounter with God or a specific kind of divine encounter with God, we could and should be open to a lifelong encounter with God that encompasses all kinds of ways that God engages with us and recognizes that these encounters aren't separate from the rest of our life, but they're a part of this journey that we are on with God. As we go through life and things feel heavy and things feel hard, sometimes we seek and long for a divine encounter because we just need an escape from what we're going through. But divine encounters are not escapes for Abraham, nor are they for us. They are steps on the way. And so are our experiences with our family. And so are our experience with colleagues and friends and others around us. When we think about divine encounters, we should recognize that each one can be significant, but no single encounter is really the one defining point of our life or our relationship with God. We shouldn't put that kind of weight or expectation on encounters we have had or on ones that we might have. That if I can just have this, that's going to make everything okay. If I could just encounter God this way, or everything's fine because I had this one thing in the past. No single encounter can carry that weight or expectation. As I reflect on Abraham's encounters with God, it seems like God is more concerned with a lifelong journey than with individual events. And all the ups and downs in life are a part of this lifelong journey with God that we've been invited into. All the stuff between the things that are clearly divine encounters, they're just as significant and important in moving us forward on this journey God has for us. And we don't always do it well. Abraham did not always do it well, but God was there and kept moving with them. God is still there and present in those times too. As I was thinking about how would I describe what Abraham lived out, I thought about the title of a book by Eugene Peterson. And the title is a line he actually repurposed that had originated with Friedrich Nietzsche, which is an unusual combination of people. But the book is called A Long Obedience in the Same Direction. I think that's an apt description of Abraham's life. Rather than chasing, okay, I just need this one thing, what if we just keep walking this road, this long obedience in the same direction where God's going to show up in different ways, at different times, in different places, and people are going to show up at different times, in different ways, in different places, and when we look back at it, we'll be able to say, oh, look how God was there working with us and moving with us all along. I think this long obedience in the same direction is an apt summary of what it looks like to embrace this lifelong encounter with the divine. And that's ultimately the invitation that is open for us today and each day. Will you keep walking in this long obedience in the same direction, this lifelong encounter with God? Let me pray and then we'll sing another song to wrap things up. God, we just thank you that you do meet us in different ways and different places as we need and as we are open. God, I thank you that you're with us for the long haul. That we don't need to look back and hold on to everything that was, although that shapes who we are. And we don't need to have a certain thing tomorrow for things to be okay. That we can just keep walking this road, knowing that you're with us on this lifelong journey. God, give us strength today to take the next step. And the day after that, to take the next step. And the day after that, to take the next step, knowing you are with us each step of the way. In Jesus' name, amen.